Welcome to this week's Property Matters on Dublin South FM, the show that brings global trends to an Irish audience. You can contact us on Twitter at iPropertyRadio or by email at hello@ipropertyradio.com. Your host is myself, Carol Tallon. Due to ongoing COVID-19 restrictions, we're recording remotely, so my apologies for any poor sound quality. Hopefully the line will hold up. So first up, I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Angus Burns, partner at Grant Thornton. Angus, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me, Carol.
I'm delighted because we want to talk about something that, you know, we haven't touched on for a few months here on the show, but it's a particularly important issue and one that we want to get to grips with today. So we're going to talk about tax-efficient property investing. So first of all, you might just outline for our audience the role that you play.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I'm a partner in Grant Thornton, but I also act as a pensioner trustee, okay? And this is particularly from the standpoint of using pension structures to invest in buy-to-let property, okay? Okay. Every one of these pension trusts require a pensioner trustee to act as trustee and just to ensure that revenue rules are followed. After that, it's up to the investor to go ahead and, you know, choose investments and invest in properties as they wish.
Okay, and just can you give maybe a broad profile of the type of client you might deal with?
Yeah, so we're coming from the perspective of buy-to-let property, be it commercial property units or more commonly buy-to-let residential properties, so flats, apartments, houses, been very popular investment asset class, let's say, for ordinary Irish people over the years, but it's got progressively more difficult to invest in the buy-to-let properties sector. Now, we know well about the various rules around rent control, but we also know that there's been very significant taxation and even tax on tax for landlords in this sector. Look, maybe there's a political angle for it. Maybe landlords are out of sorts these days. We know that banks are much more reluctant to lend to the buy-to-let investor, and we know that landlords continue to exit the sector. But there are some investors coming into the sector, and we see that they're using structures that are more tax efficient and make more sense in terms of going about those investments.
Okay, and before we get into maybe looking at what those structures are, in terms of who the new investors coming into the market, you know, are they likely to be self-employed people or employees looking to shore up their pension?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's an ongoing theme that, you know, that the self-employed sector and even people working in the private sector are very concerned about the future. Will they have enough to live in the future? And do they just want to build up a decent bunch of assets there that they'll have some wealth in the future? And traditionally, that was through maybe buying a buy-to-let property. You know, the other route is maybe also tax-efficient investing through a life and pensions, a normal kind of pension, let's say. But bricks and mortar was a favourite way to build up some kind of wealth for the future, just becoming harder and harder to do that with the way taxes is structured now.
Yeah. And look, again, today we're speaking maybe in the context of a marketplace that's absolutely disrupted on foot of COVID-19. But in terms of trends, you were seeing like over the past decade, as the market was in recovery, is this something that private investors had an interest in?
It is. And there's really great opportunity out there because you have a situation where as landlords exit the market, they're exiting because perhaps they're under pressure from their lenders. Mm-hmm. Their lenders might have sold their loans onto these vulture funds. They want to get their money back. The normal pillar banks are not lending to buy-to-let investors in the same way that they were lending previously. So you have an outflow of landlords from the sector. At the same time, you have unprecedented demand for renting in the sector. So you have a depression of value and a depression of prices for investment properties. Now, I'm not talking about your owner-occupied houses, which is a different market. I'm talking about investor properties, and particular locations are sometimes more suited, and types of properties more suited to investors than owner-occupiers. But there's been a flight of landlords from this sector, all the while the demand for rent has been increasing. So that we're in a situation where these properties in Dublin and regional cities represent, on the face of it, good value because rents are so high. Okay, so you're in a situation where yields, which is your yardstick for investment return, is relatively high in this country. Net yields of 8-9% can be quite common in Dublin. If you go to the UK and the continent, you'll often see half that level of yield. So it's a very special situation that we're in Ireland at the minute, born out of perhaps a dysfunctional taxation system that does not favour landlords purchasing personally.
Yeah, and do you see any shift in that, Angus?
Politically, it's very hard because while you have enormous demand for rental and local government and the government sector driving rents really through, you know, various rental supports, at the same time it seems that the landlord is somewhat persona non grata, maybe deemed to be profiting at the expense of others, whereas the reality is that many landlords are actually accidental landlords and really struggling to subsidize debt and to keep their head above water with investments and to pay the various taxes associated with same.
Yeah, look, I think property investing in Ireland, it has something of a brand or reputation problem as well. And we've allowed our marketplace to become much too adversarial because we've always broken it down into market winners and market losers. And that just doesn't tell the full story of the true demand and supply and the needs of people, not just necessarily in private accommodation, whether it's social housing or affordable housing. You know, it's a much larger conversation that needs to take place. But for today, you might just start by going through, because this is one of the things that we have touched on the show previously, the different vehicles and what options are available and the different structures for property investing in Ireland.
Yeah, so as a private individual, generally most, unless you've won the lotto or received an inheritance, most individuals earn their money from employment or a trade. Okay, the problem with our system in this country is that we're taxed very heavily on income tax. You know, 52% up to 55% income tax. I mean, who would have thought that we'd be handing over most of the money we earn over to revenue? Over 50% of the amount. Mm-hmm. So you're already if you wanted to set off on the buy to let journey, you're already starting off with a position where you have less than half of monies available because you've just written a large check for income tax from the monies that you're withdrawing from your employment and your job. And then once you set off on that journey, then again you have the same very high income tax rates, including USC of up to 11%. On your rental income. So you have tax on tax. If you did manage to get some kind of a loan to purchase property, very difficult to service that debt with high levels of taxation. So that many people are in a situation where they have to subsidize the debt repayments. And look, I've many friends who, as soon as they're out of negative equity on the apartments they bought 12 years ago, then they're going to sell and they're going to be out and there's no asset there for the future because they want out.
Yeah. But so what are the, I suppose, dealing with the situation that we have today, and I know we're actually even this week is a difficult time to be having this conversation as we see the new programme for government is just being negotiated. So we still don't know what the likely scenario will be for budget 2021. So what kind of advice are you giving your clients at the moment in terms of the different structures that are available?
So, I mean, there are a number of structures. I mean, there's ability to use small companies to hold property. Corporation tax rates are lower for rental income in a company versus as an individual. Also, if you generate your monies from a company, as most people work for a company, it is possible to move monies between companies in a group. So certainly that is one option. We focus very heavily on the use of pension trusts. So this is your normal pension. You know, we saw property capital allowances phased out and many of the tax reliefs phased out over the years. But the pension was relatively untouched. And why? Because it has the word pension in it. It is something there for the future. But it's a very generous tax relief. Up to 2 million euro in size of assets can be kept in a pension up into retirement age. Effectively, it means rather than receiving a salary or taking a bonus out of a company employer, it is possible to move monies that are due to you into a pension trust without any deduction of tax. Okay, so let's say 10,000 euro was due to you. You might pay over 5,000 euro in tax, but doing it this way, you move the 10,000 without any taxation into a pension trust. And from there, you use those monies to purchase property or even borrow in the pension. Debt is available to pension investors. And then once the asset, the property is in the pension trust and it's bought, as the rents come into the pension bank account, there's no taxation on those rents either. Okay, so you can see that your yield of 8-9% really is that. You're not giving up half of it to the tax man. And over time, it's much easier to grow a property portfolio, buying and selling houses and building up that pot of wealth for the future in a tax efficient vehicle.
Okay, and then you might just give us some insights into the key revenue restrictions on such a property purchase.
Yeah, so if this is a tax-exempt structure, mm-hmm. Okay, most of us live in the after-tax world, which means we pay VAT, we pay income tax, we pay capital gains tax, and we live very much in an after-tax world. The pension is a pre-tax world. There's no tax in it. So there has to be some rules around the operation of the pension trust. One is that there should be a pensioner trustee, like myself, appointed to every self-administered pension. This is a revenue requirement. Why? They want to make sure that the beneficiary of the pension does not abuse the revenue rules, which include an arm's length rule. So existing properties that you might own personally cannot be sold into a pension because that's not arm's length. However, you can go off into the market and buy from a property agent into your pension. That is an arm's length investment. And that's probably the key restriction, which extends to connected parties as well. Just making sure that the rules are respected for this tax exempt structure.
Okay. And again, this isn't something, it has to be a property that is ready for letting, as in this isn't suitable for property development.
Well, there's two views on it. We have clients who will take run-down property and fix them up. All the expenses of fixing up the properties paid for by the pension, so using tax-exempt monies to fix it up. And then once the property is finished, then it is rented and the rents come in. What is prohibited is trading in the pension. So what revenue don't want to see is you effectively running a business through your pension trust. Now, I know that sounds daft and you know that the pension trust is supposed to be for investments only. But let's say you had a couple of half-built properties, let's say, or even you were building some properties in your pension. You're quite entitled to hold on to those assets as investments going forward. What is an investment? Well, maybe receipt a rental income that would show that it's an investment. But let's say you sold those properties immediately and went again and you kept on selling. Well, really, you're a property developer there and that's your trade. Okay, mm-hmm. So revenue don't want to see a trade. They do want to see investments, and there can be a subtle difference between the two.
Okay, well then, in terms of, because I think there's a lot of confusion around this, and certainly it's something that we've touched on over the past year on various shows. So actually, it would be good to get some clarity on revenue borrowing guidelines.
So on the borrowing guidelines for debt, then, really the rules are stacked against lenders, okay, in that there's no personal guarantees allowed on any debt in a pension structure. It should all be non-recourse, non-collateralized. Now, you might say that's wonderful for a borrower because it doesn't extend, the debt does not extend to any personal assets. However, it does make it harder for a bank to lend on the basis that there are no personal guarantees. The upside for a bank, though, however, is that because there's no taxation on income in the pension trust, it means there's so much more headroom to support repayments to the bank. So on that perspective, the structure is very attractive to banks. The downside for banks is that they can't take personal guarantees or cross-collateralized debt. So for the borrower, it's somewhat of a win-win. If they're able to secure the lending into pensions, it's a very good structure to have.
Okay, and then just before we finish up, you might just kind of give some final words of advice, because you've been very good to make some of this information available to us, and we'll upload it to the Irish or the IP Radio. We'll upload that onto the website. But just in terms of final advice for our audience here.
Yeah, I mean, like many people are ambitious to grow their personal wealth for the future, okay? But we can be busy fools as well, trying to invest, trying to make money, taking risk, but really doing it in a manner that's not efficient at all. So just a little bit of planning, a step back, and to say, look, how do we want to structure things going forward can make for a much easier ride and a much faster way to hit a target number for the future. It's all about personal wealth accumulation and doing it in the easiest and most efficient manner.
Okay, that makes sense. Angus Burns, partner at Grant Thornton, thank you so much for being with us today. Again, you've made information available to us, and we'll put that on the iPropertyRadio.com website. We have to leave it there for now. Our thanks again to Angus Burns, partner at Grant Thornton. We'll take a quick break. Stay tuned.
93.9 Dublin South FM.
Welcome back to Property Matters on Dublin South FM with myself, Carol Tallon. You can contact us on Twitter at iPropertyRadio or by email at hello@iPropertyRadio.com. I'm delighted to be joined on the phone now by Marie Cafferty, CEO of UniversalFloral.com. Marie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here, Carol. Thanks for inviting me.
Marie, I'm a long-term fan of your product and your service, and I have two of your beautiful plants that were in my office. We actually, just weeks before the shutdown, we actually hired a van and a driver to take our plants from the office to the home office so that they would be well maintained during this time. So I'm already a fan of your product. But for people listening in, you might just explain, what does Universal Floral do?
Oh, definitely, Carol. No, but what we do is we supply and maintain planting for offices. We specialize in sustainable interior planting and exteriors for courtyards. We also look after cut flowers for receptions, artificial planting, and what's very big at the moment are living and moss walls. So I would say that we can support the entire planting needs for the client.
Yeah. And Marie, I think maybe people will be familiar with, certainly you share amazing images of projects that you've done on LinkedIn and other social media. But I'm interested to know how you got into this. So what's your background, or what were you doing prior to Universal Floral?
Oh, sugar. I think that Universal Floral has always been in my blood, Carol. My father started a business over 50 years ago. So okay. As a child, I was always in the garden. I was always surrounded by nature. My parents are huge into planting. And my dad had a business, and I was just always surrounded by planting. I did delve into other areas like film production and that, and I did a business course. But when my dad asked me to come back and run the business, I was delighted to get involved.
And Very good.
I run it with my brothers. So it's a real family business, and we're all very much involved.
Yeah. And, you know, when you say family business, you know, there's a tendency to think that that might be a small or local business, whereas looking at the projects you're involved in, your work can be seen in some of the most stunning and photographed contemporary office buildings throughout Dublin for very large international brands. Can yes. you talk to us about some of the projects you've been involved in?
Yes, yes. We've been involved in a lot of projects. Most recently, we did a HubSpot. We looked after artificial planting for a HubSpot, also for Indeed. We're doing a big job now for HubSpot in Berlin. We look after, let's say, Central Bank. We do a lot of WeWork, eBay, PayPal, very long-standing clients of ours. We look after many clients from tech companies to hospitals, hotels.
Right. I didn't realize that Universal Floral was so long established, because I've been familiar with the business for a couple of years, but I didn't realize that it was a second generation business.
Yes, yes, it is. Hopefully third generation now with the little kids coming up.
Good. That would be fantastic to see. But so actually, I mean, I was really interested to talk to you because about changing office trends, because, you know, it's something we've discussed on the show, you know, when we're talking about office, and particularly in a prop tech environment, when we're talking about the new technology that's really seen, that's influencing changes or being influenced by changes in office, in office use and office trends. But actually, given the history of the company there, you actually have a much longer or broader than perspective on how office trends have changed. I mean, in the early years, was it all interior planting you were doing?
Yes, it was all interior planting. And I guess as well, Carol, at the time, there wasn't a huge selection of pots, and he didn't have Instagram and Pinterest at the time. So definitely in the last 10 years, there's been a huge movement for pots. People want lots of different styles, like planters with textures, lava planters, bamboo, rattan. Also as well, you have screeners coming in, moss, living walls are huge now as well. There is, because you have like Pinterest and Instagram and Facebook, you have a lot of ideas from all over the world. And everyone likes, every client is different. Every client has new ideas. There's a client that we're putting in some planting now next week. And they have, we've organized a light and a plant installation for them. So they're looking forward to that.
And actually, can you explain that? What do you mean a light?
What it is it's, we have a light, a log light hanging from the ceiling, and we have natural planting incorporated within the log, and that will come down. So it'll be it's a new one for us, but
stunning.
Yeah, it'll be stunning. Absolutely, absolutely. And then our moss walls and our living walls, 20-foot long living walls. I think what we're very good at, I think because we're a family business, we're very creative, and we're always thinking about how best to serve our customer and our clients. So we always love new ideas. If clients come to us with a new idea, we really grab that, and we love to give it our best.
Yeah, there seems to be much more of a shift in terms of, you know, design trends change all the time, but certainly it appears to kind of a non-design person like myself that actually plants plants are becoming a huge focal part of interior design, particularly for offices. And that tallies well with, you know, the whole move we're seeing towards healthy buildings and building wellness factors. But what's driving this change?
Well, I think the humans, we always want to be in touch with the natural world. And then by incorporating natural materials into the built environment, it helps people feel more at ease. Looking at green is relaxing to the eyes, especially when people are looking at computer screens all the time. The natural environment, bringing it inside, it really brings a lot of, I suppose, rest, a lot of, it makes people re-energized. It helps people within an office environment. And then with our business, we maintain the planting every 2 weeks. So our maintenance staff will be on site every 2 weeks, and they look after the planting on site. And when we say look after the planting, it's a bi-monthly maintenance where we water, we dust, we prune, we fertilize, and we replace any planting fading. I call it like plant housekeeping, because that's what we do. and is a very important part of keeping your planting looking their best.
Yeah, well, look, I grew up on a farm, so I'm naturally drawn to the outdoors. But when it comes to maintaining indoor plants, that's a real challenge for me. So actually, you mentioned there that your team is involved in dusting. Frankly, I was 40 years of age when I heard that indoor plants had to be dusted. You know, these are things that people just don't understand, you know, that maybe they don't understand the upkeep. And would that be a fear that people would have, as in if they're going to invest in something so beautiful for their office, that, you know, are they worried about the maintenance and the upkeep?
Well, that's what we do in the office, because everybody really is so busy that they don't have time. And I think what's very important for planting is planting, like humans, they like routine. And that's very mm-hmm. important for plants. When we come in every 2 weeks, the plants know, okay, we're going to be watered, we're going to be looked after, we're going to be dusted. And it's the same. They're very, like when I say about plants, they are very like humans. They feel stressed when they're not watered. They get, you know, they get kind of excited. So that once we look after them, they'll grow with us and they'll thrive with us. And plants are very strong as well. So I really feel that when they are looked after, they will thrive. And when the planting thrive, people see the new growth. And it's exciting and it's life.
Yeah, it definitely is. And that's something that's so important at the moment. And, you know, obviously there's been such a major shift in terms of office use over the past 3 months. With so many people working from home, you know, there's definitely a conversation happening now. You know, will people go back to the office 5 days a week? Are we looking at some sort of a hybrid, part-time working from home, part-time in the office? And things like this are going to make, you know, I can remember actually it was somebody within HubSpot I heard speaking on a panel. And, you know, she spoke about how, you know, one of the points of competition that an office has now at the moment is the fact that employees have the option to work from home, that essentially the office has to compete to be more attractive yeah. than working from home. And, you know, bringing in greenery is a huge part of that. But I saw on LinkedIn that, you know, over the past month, as businesses are reopening, we've seen all this perspex going everywhere. And look, we understand it's necessary. It's something that needs to be done, you know, for the public health. However, I saw you had a really creative solution. The moss screens, yes. What are they and how do they work?
Oh, the moss screens are wonderful, Carol. They're a new product of ours. They come in, it's like a room screener. It's got little wheels in mm-hmm. it, but we can add different frames. So for example, a client recently, they had a pure reindeer moss screen. And what you can do is, instead of your usual screeners that you're probably used to in the office, I think they're usually blue and they have wheels. This is a screener, mm-hmm. but it has natural elements to it. For example, the reindeer moss I was talking about. But you could also have a sustainable bark, or you could have a mountain grey stone or a brown light stone. So this is a screener. Instead of just being a blue felt screener, this is a screener mm-hmm. that has natural elements. And you also, on the other side of the screener, you can have a writable on it. So you can write on the screen. So it's very good now.
So like a whiteboard situation
exactly.
or something?
Exactly. It's like a whiteboard situation.
Ah, does it have the same acoustic benefits? Because part of the, you know, part of having these screens in offices, it's not just about privacy. You know, it's soundproofing at a low level, you know, maybe where phone contact would happen.
Yeah.
So in terms of acoustic performance, do the moss screens fulfill that function?
They do. They are very efficient acoustic modulators. And the moss, it's preserved naturally. It's 100% biodegradable. And it's also fire retardant. So there's a host of benefits with these screeners. They also come in different sizes as well, Carol. So they're very complementary to an office space.
Okay. And in terms of supply, just because we know that only last week, the estate agencies around the country returned to the office. And I know, particularly in the southwest of the country, there were companies, and actually up in County Louth, there were companies that were having difficulty in sourcing perspex and sourcing different materials that are now needed in order to make the offices safe for members of the public to come in and interact with staff. So in terms of supplies and your supply chain, Are you in a position to satisfy demand for that corporates might have at the moment?
Yeah, Carol, I can provide within 10 days.
Okay. And in terms of people returning to the office, actually, first of all, have your team been going into offices that were closed to maintain the plants?
Yes, we're still working. The only difference now is that instead of going in probably at a time that I had like a nice, neat routine for the staff, now what we're doing is we're being very flexible. And if a client wants us in, let's say 10 a.m. on a Monday, we will do that. We've been very flexible, even working out of hours. There was no issues there. It's very important for us to keep to that routine of keeping the plants looking their best, because the clients, they have staff coming in and out. And the last thing you want to see is when you go into an office and the plants are fading. So we've definitely been very, very flexible. And it stands to us as a family business of 50 years. Most of our staff have been with us 10 years and they do know the clients. We take security very, very seriously. So we'd have the same maintenance technician in the office for, we don't change technicians. So you're always guaranteed the same person, the same time. So that's very important. Mm-hmm. And that has held us through the last few weeks with our clients. The last few weeks were very challenging, but it did give us an opportunity to touch base with each of our clients again. So I found that very, very good. It was very beneficial because as we were so busy during the last year, it was nice to call up the client again. How are you doing? It's been a while. Most of our clients have been with us for maybe 10, 15, 20 years. So it was touching base with them again, which I found was nice. And
That's an interesting one. And actually, Marie, you're not the first person to say that to me. You know, when we talked about working remotely, one of the things that came up is that actually there was very much a deepening of client relationships, clients that we were working with on an ongoing basis. You know, sometimes that can become a little bit remote when the work is quite automated and well set up. But actually, over the past few months, you know, people are reporting a real deepening of client relationships. And that's something that's really positive. And I do think that's because perhaps it was either through phone calls or Zoom calls, but actually there was direct contact as opposed to email, and that mightn't have happened for months before that. So it is something we're seeing. And before we let you go, you know, Marie, on the show here, we're always talking about changing trends, whether it's for residential or commercial property. And usually these trends are driven, you know, by technology changes. So in terms of design and interior landscaping, what kind of trends are you expecting to see, or what changes are you seeing at the moment?
Well, there's a big draw towards sustainability, Carol. I'd say the planters with textures, lava planters are a new product that we have.
What are they?
A ceramic planter, but it's made from the traditional way using wood-fired ovens. So that's like a new product, and it's going back to the old way of making pots. But also what we do is we have pots that are made from recycled computers, like recycled from old computers. So sustainability is a big key factor. Also what's very important for us is putting the right plant in the right place. And that's why we always ask our clients to visit their office so we can view where planting would best suit. As well,
it's something that we've just seen a trend growing over the past number of years, and you know, so it's amazing to hear of new innovation coming out. I mean, being able to reuse computers for the pots, you know, things like that. These are things that are just being driven by innovation, and it's really exciting to see. So, Marie, I will continue to enjoy your images as you share them on LinkedIn and other places. But for people who now want to take a look at your work, where's the best place to find it?
Yeah, universalfloral.com is our website, universalfloral.com. And I'm eager to hear from anybody, Carl. I love when people give me, let's say, a plan for an office, or they invite me into future office. I view every office there. Every office is different. And that's why you have to offer that client something different for them, a different pot or different plants. It's every office is different. So no client has exact same as another client. And it's really exciting.
Yeah, no, look, absolutely. Absolutely, you're right. And that is one of the exciting things about working with new clients as well. And look, I would definitely recommend anybody who is looking for pandemic responsive solutions, but doesn't want to kind of just stick with the perspex in areas where that's not necessary, to take a look at your MOS screens. They really are beautiful and functional. And I imagine a whole host of benefits beyond just being pandemic responsive. Marie, thank you so much for joining us today.
93.9 Dublin South FM.
And welcome back to Property Matters on Dublin South FM with myself, Carol Tallon. We are, of course, recording from home as the radio station operates remotely in full compliance with government guidelines. So I'm now joined over the phone by Ed Burke, founder of Roomego. Ed, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Carol, for having me on.
No, I'm delighted. And of course, you've been a regular guest on the show discussing the topic of co-living, because co-living in Ireland got off to quite a controversial start. And, you know, it's one that the housing minister has been very supportive of, but he's drawn a lot of criticism for his support. So this is an issue we've seen back in the news in recent weeks when members of the political opposition have actually spoken out and said, you know, this should really be the final nail in the coffin of co-living. But it seems to be the most misunderstood asset class in Ireland. So can we go back to the beginning, Ed, and you might just explain to people who aren't familiar, what is co-living in an Irish context?
I think it's a very important point you make there. It has been misunderstood in Ireland. Co-living, at its most basic, is effectively a professionally managed house share. I mean, although house shares can actually work very well, particularly for young people, you're sharing a home with a few other people. If they're friends of yours, you can have a great time together. It helps split costs in terms of rent and bills. One of the problems is people are now sharing homes into their 30s, and they're getting married a lot older, buying their first home older. So a situation has developed where you have young professionals leaving college, and instead of being in a house share for a couple of years like might have been the case in the past, they're now house sharing for, it could be well over a decade, but the market hasn't really developed products for that young professional demographic, even though I think something like 33% of Dublin's workforce is aged between their early 20s to late 30s. So it's really important that we develop solutions, because you have situations where you could be in your late 20s. You might be living in a red brick house which has one bathroom and there might be four bedrooms in it. One room might have a couple and the other three rooms might have single people. You then have situations of people queuing for the bathroom in the morning, which mightn't have been done up in 20 years. You mightn't know who the landlord is, which is a big problem. People don't know who their landlords are and never communicate with them. Stuff mightn't be fixed. So there's a situation of, you know, well over 100,000 people in Dublin that house share. So co-living is really about trying to effectively scale up the house share and put it into a larger building, and provide a professionally managed service. Because I actually ran a survey before Christmas through my company Roomego, which is all about connecting like-minded housemates. Mm-hmm. Majority of respondents on that survey said it's actually really important for them to have a good relationship with their landlord. And another problem they identified, one of the biggest problems, was problems within properties such as mold or items not being fixed or on time, or, you know, are not at all. So these are kind of really big issues for young people, and the issue hasn't been tackled. So co-living is effectively a response to that. Now, co-living comes in many different shapes and sizes, and people have different ideas as to what co-living should be. It is taking off in other countries. So I think it's without doubt that we do need professionally managed house shares, which is basically co-living, scaled up. And the question is how to scale it up and do it in such a way that maintains that great sense of community you can have in a small house share with just three or four or five other people, and make that work in a bigger building. And to get the balance right between privacy and sharing. So these are issues that I think are very important.
You put a strong emphasis on community, and I think that maybe that's the misunderstood element, or maybe the underestimated element in this type of housing, because the type of co-living, you know, having flatmates, housemates, the kind of thing that we have done, you know, really forever, or certainly in the last number of decades, that was usually driven by a commercial imperative, you know, so that as soon as people got to the stage where they could afford their own, whether it was to rent or buy, that they would then have their own. So I think maybe part of the confusion is coming from people choosing to live with other people, like having housemates in your 30s, as something that's a commercial imperative as opposed to a choice. And so one of the frustrating things in Ireland was to see the first co-living offerings coming to the market, and they were priced exceptionally high. So I think that that's maybe where a lot of the early criticism came from. And I suppose judging this purely based on price, like not taking in the community or even the convenience element, you know, maybe for short-term leases, that seems to be where a lot of the criticism is coming from. And there's some of that is correct. We need to have an offering that's good value. And at the moment, that just wasn't really an option in Ireland. The offerings were just too high. You know, you were talking about, you know, sometimes 1600 to 1800 euros for a very tiny room, which we've seen likened to the square footage of parking spaces.
Yeah, I mean, I think community is very important. And it's about connecting with people, and that's a very, very important aspect of co-living. People know that there's a massive problem with loneliness in cities. People don't know who their neighbours are. So co-living is almost like trying to bring that kind of village kind of atmosphere of a community that connects with each other into the residential market. And indeed, even in the office market, offices are now being designed so that they're more open plan and people can communicate with each other more easily. So there is a need for residential properties that really focus on bringing that sense of community to living, and that's what co-living is all about. It's almost like a support network as well for people. They can connect with people, connect with like-minded people with shared passions and interests. And there have been a number of co-living proposals at the planning stage, and they have got a little bit of criticism. I suppose quite a lot of criticism in some respects, but definitely price and rent is an issue. More expensive co-living offerings, are a viable option for people that can pay. Can pay for it. Some people will pay for a really premium product, but there's definitely a need for a product that is affordable. And to figure out what affordable is, you figure out what the salary of, let's say, the average salary of a young professional in their, let's say, late 20s is, and you divide that by three, and that's going to come out probably at a range of under 1,000 euro. So,
but yet none of the offerings are coming close to that.
No, they're not. So that is one issue that needs to be tackled. I think we do need to try to encourage more types of co-living that aim at providing a product that is affordable for the, let's say, the average or the mid-market, and then to think about the co-living in terms of design and what is actually the most effective design for creating communities and encouraging communities to form. And I have my own views on this, and my view is that the co-living building should be split into clusters, where instead of having tons of people, like 20 plus sharing kitchens, you might have four or five people sharing a kitchen, because I believe the kitchen is one of the spaces that people place a higher emphasis on privacy, having access to a kitchen where you can share that with just your closest mates, because sometimes it's not realistic in a large building that you're going to get on with everybody. So you might want to be able to confine certain spaces just to the people that you do get on very well with, like a kitchen, whereas you might still want access to a larger communal area that's designed for 30 or 40 or 50 people, you know, that you can access when you want to get to know that wider community, but you still have your own cluster of kind of closer mates the co-living company helps kind of match together, so they common passions and interests.
But okay, but first of all, you know, we're getting into very subjective territory there when we're talking about personality matching, you know, for the tenants that you're going to be sharing with. But can we just maybe step back a bit and look at the applications that have gone through and the applications that are pending in Ireland? So basically the proposals, even in Ireland, how many people are expected to share a kitchen at present?
Well, I don't know the exact numbers. I can't remember, but I think we were talking around the region of 20, you know, in those in some of those buildings, if not a little more. And I think that has caused a lot of upset in the media. They've jumped on this idea that the co-living operators are, you know, are trying to get 20 people to share kitchens. I think what they're trying to do is the idea of 20 people sharing kitchens. I think they believe that will result in communities more easily forming as it will encourage people to interact. But I don't necessarily believe we need to design buildings in that way to encourage, you know, community engagement. And I think one of the problems is the actual sizes of the rooms that the co-living operators are proposing. They might actually, there may not be a problem with the size of the room itself. It's just that I think the media is percepting that the room is trying to be like a flatter apartment, which they're not trying to be. They're actually they're basically a bedroom with an ensuite and a kitchenette. So it's not trying to be an apartment. And I think there's a little bit of misunderstanding there, because if you take a normal house share or a normal apartment that they build in Dublin, the rooms in those houses are probably, you know, I don't think that they're going to be substantially bigger than the proposed rooms in these co-living units. It's just that people think that the co-living unit is a mini flat when it's not. It's really meant to be your, you know, a room within an apartment.
So we're liking it more to a hotel room.
Yeah, we're liking it more to a hotel room. But I think it's also to do with the design of the fact that they've got 20 or 30 people sharing kitchens makes it seem like it makes it seem more like a hotel room. So that's why I would suggest that they kind of maybe think about the layouts, and instead of having 20 or 30 people sharing rooms, have kitchens have 4 or 5 people sharing kitchens. And there is actually objective research on this. There's one shared house is an online survey run by Space 10, which is an IKEA kind of innovation arm, and they've had 150,000 responses to their survey in co-living, and most people are saying that they actually prefer smaller co-living communities. So like the smallest option in their survey was 4 to 10, and most people were selecting the smallest option. So I think there is actually objective evidence out there to say that human beings like forming in smaller clusters. But the great thing about the co-living community is it can be set up in a way that you have your small cluster, and then you can have other clusters in the building as well. So you can get to know that larger kind of community, and you can mix with them via the communal lounges.
Okay, and I take that on board. But then if we're getting into the territory of needing to provide more kitchens, then we're getting into the territory of this being a more expensive development to deliver, which is going to push costs up even higher, which might take away the affordability element. So, you know, at the moment, this is seen as an optimum development project because of... at the moment, student accommodation is one of the most profitable forms of residential development. And co-living, if it was to work on the minimum standards we have, that could be, you know, significantly more profitable. Whereas if we need to bring in more kitchens, dedicate more space, then suddenly you're pushing that down. And will it be as attractive for developers in Ireland? And by the way, I actually don't come down on either side of this argument. I'm a proponent of co-living if it's done properly, but only if it's only if there's an affordable element of it.
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, I actually think there's an affordable element of co-living is a really important thing that we need. But I wouldn't be against the co-living models, you know, aimed at a professional that can afford to pay €1,500. I mean, if you're a very high earning professional and you want to have, you know, a top class, you know, a premium model where you get hotel-esque services, fair enough, you can pay more.
Yeah,
but I think
and we know in Dublin there absolutely is a demand for that, given our international occupiers in the offices in certain areas in Dublin. You know, so we know that there's a premium demand for people who might be coming here and only staying 6 months or a year or 2 years in Dublin, and they want a built-in community. You know, so that's an important element. And Ed, I know that you've actually visited some co-living spaces outside of Ireland to try establish best practice. So before we let you go, you might just maybe share with us who, you know, whether it's in Europe or further afield, you know, who's doing this well?
In Europe, I think the leading or the biggest operator is a company called Quarters in Berlin. I actually visited their building, and they have a model similar to what I proposed, where it's effectively split into clusters. So you might have, I think it's 2 to 4 or 5 people per cluster. And the way they have it is, within each cluster, there's a kitchen. And what they do is they take away a little bit of space in terms of the living room area, and they give that back into communal lounges. So, but you still have a kitchen, and you have either an ensuite, or I think it's max 2 people sharing a bathroom. So they don't actually have ensuites in all their rooms. The co-living regulations in Ireland require ensuite, every room to be ensuite. I think ensuite is good, or at max 2 people sharing a bathroom. And that's how they do it. They have a communal lounge, and they sort of, theirs is affordable co-living, because you can actually rent one of their rooms for €600 in their apartments. But what they say is that they take the frills out of it. So you actually, you don't get like a cleaning service, and I'm not sure if they have like a free gym in the building. And so you don't get all these like extra frills, and that way they can keep the cost low. But an idea for Ireland could be, you might necessarily need to like have all these extras in, you know, like a yoga studio or a gym in a building, but you could have a building where that have these facilities, where you do a deal with an operator, someone external who runs the gym, and, you know, give a deal to your residents, because all of these extra things do cost money as well.
Yeah, and no, but it makes sense. In every sector of the market, whether it's commercial or residential, you know, you have your premium offerings, but there needs to be, you know, there needs to be kind of that range. And that's what was really missing in when co-living was introduced into Ireland. And I think that's where a lot of the criticism has come from. Ed, just, I suppose, to put things in context about how you're in a position to talk about this, you know, because you actually have a good handle on tenants coming in. You might just remind us, how many members do you have in your Roomigo community, say, in Ireland?
So I run a platform called Roomigo, which is all about connecting like-minded housemates so they can find house shares together. So on our website, we would get over 1,000 people like on a weekly basis using the platform and spending on average over 5 minutes on it per session.
Okay, and in terms of your active Facebook groups, you know, how many people would you have contributing to that?
Well, I have a global network of Facebook groups, and that would be over 120,000 members, and you know, in the groups that I've built up.
Wow, 120 members. So really, I suppose what I'm touching on there is that, you know, if there are developers who, not just in response to COVID-19, but also in response to political opposition and community opposition to proposed co-living, you know, really they need to tap in to this network of 120 members, because they're the people who are most likely to be using this type of service or to use this type of housing, you know, to actually get feedback, to actually learn what the community wants, as opposed to making assumptions or bringing in, you know, bringing in architects who might not have specialism in this area, or they might not have a good handle on what that generation is looking for. So, Ed, just we need to finish up now, but how can people get in contact with you to be able to access these kind of community insights?
So, absolutely. I'd love to talk to people and help if they feel I can add value. They can reach out to me via LinkedIn. It's Ed Burke, or via my email, which is ed@rumigo.io.
Okay, and just the spelling of that is roomigo.io. Super. Okay, Ed, we'll leave it there for now. Again, co-living is definitely something that, you know, the conversation almost is has had a reset button. So we're going to be figuring more out about this over the coming months. And I look forward to hearing more of your insights from there. But for now, thank you for talking to us today. That's it from us in Property Matters today on Dublin South FM, the show where property matters. You can get in touch with the show by emailing hello@ipropertyradio.com or on Twitter @ipropertyradio. Our thanks again to Peter Rice on sound and show producer Katie Tallon of Hear Me Roar Media. We're back at the same time next week. From myself, Carol Tallon, and all the team here, stay safe.